Where warp meets weft.
Where warp meets weft.
This is Weavecast with Sine Mitchell.
Hello, and welcome to episode 5.5 of Weavecast, BSG Confidential. This episode is a little bit different, a little bit experimental, hence the 0.5 numbering. This summer, in June, I went to Black Sheep Gathering, a fabulous fiber festival held each year in Eugene, Oregon. And I took my iRiver. I had intended to use my iRiver to listen to books on tape on the ride down, but once I got there, I thought it would be fun to capture some audio and then present it as a reality podcast. A lot of this was recorded on the fly, using only the microphone built into the player, so the sound isn't quite what I would have liked for a Weavecast episode, but you can decide if it's worth listening to. And even if the format and the sound quality annoy you, do skip ahead to the interview with Russell Groff from Robin and Russ Hand Weaving. He has been weaving for 57 years and recently closed down a shop that was mecca for hand weavers in the Pacific Northwest, and he gave me a wonderful interview. And if you listen to nothing else on this episode, I advise you to go listen to Russ tell some of his wonderful stories from his weaving life. So without further ado, let's hop in the car and come along with me to a fiber festival. So here I am, the first night of the Black Sheep Gathering. I've checked in, I've set up my tent, and I'm hanging out at a campsite with Nancy Alegria, Sally Fox, and a whole host of other really cool people whose names I haven't learned yet. I walked through the animal tent and saw some adorable Shetland lambs, and some cute baby mohair goats and cashmere goats. I'm really looking forward to tomorrow, and we'll report back in the morning. This is your roving reporter, Sine Mitchell, signing out. Big kudos and many thanks to the Spindles and Flyers group from San Francisco. I basically invited myself along to camp with them. They were very gracious in letting me tag along and be one of the group for the weekend. It all started when Nancy Alegria emailed me and said, "Are you going to Black Sheep Gathering?" And I said, "Yes," and I was planning to camp out. And she explained that her group camped out every year and started giving me tips and tricks for where the showers were and how to get a good camping spot. And I haven't gone camping in 10 years, and I was going to be all by myself and not knowing anybody, so I basically invited myself along. I said, "Nancy, would it be okay if I camp near you guys?" And she was like, "Sure." And all her friends from the guild were there, and they were like, "Sure." And they were just a really, really fun bunch of people. If you are in the San Francisco area and you enjoy spinning, I highly recommend the Spindles and Flyers group. They are just a fun bunch of ladies. And they brought with them an assortment of adorable children who were just a joy to have around. So thank you for letting me crash your party. And that just goes to show that if you're out there and you're interested in emailing me or leaving me a comment or submitting something for this show, and for some reason you're intimidated, I'm just folks. And the only thing to really worry about is that, you know, I might show up at your house for dinner or something. Only kidding. I mean, you know, unless you were cooking something really good.
Brad?
breakfasted with the
Spindles and Flyers
Guild from San Francisco. And while we were talking and having a great time, a woman wandered over from another campsite and said, "Excuse me, does anybody here have a knitting noddy I could borrow for 10 minutes?" And I gotta say, it was one of those moments when you stand there and you go, wow, I am in a place where a question like that could be asked. And better yet, one of the members went, "Why, yes, here you go." So, how cool is that? More later.
I just came out of a class on fiber judging with Judith McKenzie, who was, as always, fabulous. And one of the interesting things was it was held in a schoolhouse, and up on the walls were quotes that the students had drawn. And up behind Judith the whole time she was talking was a Michelangelo quote that said, "Perfection is made up of trifles, but perfection is not a trifle," which I thought was just so apropos I could barely stand it. I got my very first piece of fiber work evaluated. I was supposed to bring a piece for the class to have it test judged and get some idea of how the judging process worked. And I brought this scarf, and as per normal, I didn't have it done before I left, so I got up early this morning at 5:30 a.m. and did the final fringe twisting. And my original plan was to wet finish it, but there wasn't enough dew in the grass near my campsite, so I just handed it in as is. And although it had a few skips and troubles with the selvage line and, you know, was not perfection, Judith said it was a very brave warp because I had used all kinds of random thick and nubbly and shiny and all different colors, lots of purples with the occasional shot of red just for interest. She said it was a very brave warp, and I'm not sure if that's a euphemism, but overall she gave me an imaginary red ribbon for my scarf, and I was quite pleased. I was so tickled to finally have something of mine judged that I actually took a picture of her judging it. And someone asked the question, "What would you say to people, Judith, to encourage them to show their work in a fiber show and have it judged?" Judith's answer was, "That's how our community gets together and talks." She explained that fiber creations are things that you cannot express in words alone, and that when the community gets together and puts together a body of work in a show and has it looked at and judged, that's how ideas are exchanged, how learning happens, how judges improve their craft, and how the whole hand textiles craft moves forward. So if you haven't ever shown your stuff, I would encourage you to think about it. I have never shown my stuff, and I'm going to strive to have something in the Puyallup Fair this upcoming fall. I'm going to leave you off from this report with just a few of the other quotes that I thought were notable that I wrote down from around the top of the room. So thank you, students. "The man who does not read good books has no advantage over the man who can't read them," Mark Twain. "I hear and I forget, I see and I remember, I do and I understand." And I didn't get the author of that quote. This is one of my favorites. "Failure is the opportunity to begin again more intelligently," Henry Ford. Something I think about every time I fail, or something I should think about every time I fail. "All glory comes from daring to begin," by Eugene Ware. How many times have we had a fabulous idea and just been too scared to follow up? That's all for this report. I'll pick up with you again after lunch. So I'm standing here in the livestock pen of the Black Sheep Gathering. I am surrounded by a sea of green metal gates, each of which contains different types of sheep. So why don't we just do a little interview here? I'm standing here next to a naturally colored Corydale. Is this your first BSG? Really? And how do you feel about being a sheep? Are you interested in fiber production? Oh, grass. Okay. And would you say that grain is your favorite foodstuffs?
Now here's where I get busted. The lady who owned the sheep
saw me talking to her ewes and pointing my eye river in their direction to get their responses, and decided to see what the heck was going on.
Are these yours?
These black ones down there were the black curtains on it.
Oh, cool. It's fun to get to see all the different types of breeds.
Yeah, there's a lot of them. I mean, people don't realize how many breeds of sheep there are until you get them all together. And this, what comes to these shows is just a small percentage of what the different breeds.
Now, although the name of the festival is the Black Sheep Gathering, it also plays host to a whole range of fiber animals, including Angora bunnies, Angora goats, and, to my amazement and delight, actual cashmere goats. And I have to confess, I have a deep and abiding love for cashmere fiber. I have this delicate Irish skin, so even baby alpaca just feels a little too harsh for me, and I tend to wear either merinos or cottons, silks, and of course, my fave, cashmere. So I couldn't help sneaking a little bit closer and asking some questions of a local cashmere breeder.
Hi, so are those actual cashmere goats?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, are those babies or grown-ups?
They're 5 months old.
Oh, so how much bigger do they get?
At least double that size.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they'll get about yay high.
These are about waist height or
the top of my hip
height.
Yeah.
Cool. And how much fiber do you get off a cashmere, like a handful a year? Or?
Yeah, pretty much. It's for like a two-year-old animal, you might get 4 ounces of cashmere per year.
They're beautiful animals, though.
That's why it's pricey.
Yeah. They're lovely.
Yeah, they're very cute. These guys are wethers, they're neutered males, and they've been sold for a brush job.
Sold for a brush job?
Yeah, they love to eat blackberries.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm. I have little Shetland sheep, and they go after the blackberries, too. Mm-hmm. So, do they do well in rainy climates,
Remember
like
here,
the Northwest?
Are you ready? They hate rain.
Ah.
You know what? You have cashmere goats out in the field and it'll start to rain and they will run to the barn.
Oh, wow.
They just walk to the barn and they will run. I don't know why that is. They just do not like rain.
Well, that's good. They stay dry. You probably don't have as much trouble with foot rot.
Well, that's true.
And stuff like
that.
But that's why I ended up with Shetlands, is I live in a very rainy area.
Uh-huh.
And Shetlands are from Scotland.
Oh, yeah.
So they're used to it. It's cold and rainy. That's what they know.
Well, right? Yeah, the cashmere seem to kind of know better than to be out in the rain. As long as they have any kind of a shelter. Sometimes I just put a tarp over a cattle panel.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll be enough.
Very cool. I just want to climb over the fence and start combing them.
Yeah, actually that was releasing some of the fluff that he was born in end of January, and so
uh-huh.
It was still pretty cold, and he put on some undercoat.
Is it hard to get the fiber dehaired?
Well, yeah, you either hand pick it or you send it off to a machine to do it, and the machine dehairing is pretty expensive. They usually charge by the incoming weight for cashmere, so if I send in 10 pounds of cashmere, that's only going to produce if not very much. It's mostly hair. The hair
right.
weighs more, so.
Right. Oi, I have shopped until I have dropped. And I wasn't supposed to be buying anything this trip. There are like two warehouses full of fiber, yarn, wooden tool, books. Vendors, just mind-boggling. I mean, it's to the point where my head hurts and I cannot shop anymore. It's just all blurring one into the other. But I found so many cool things that you just don't see anywhere else. I found yarn gauges for gauging the thickness and the angle of the yarn. I found little rubber stamps for paper that say hand spun by, hand woven by, and have a little picture of a drop spindle and a shuttle respectively. I found books for children about fiber crafts. I found even child size hand combs, and I found a beautiful, beautiful upright distaff that I did not buy, but I am lusting after much in my heart. And it was actually a fairly good price, but I'm trying not to buy anything I don't absolutely, absolutely need to have for a current in-progress project. But, yeah, not having complete luck. I am just worn out from shopping. I think I've been shopping for 6 hours straight. And I'm going to have a bit of a lie down in the tent. I'll get back with more later.
An interesting thing about Black Sheep Gathering is just how kid-friendly it is. If you camp out, there's this large green space where the kids can run around, and everybody there is very friendly, and there are animals for the children to go look at, and there are classes and demonstrations and fiber galleries. So there were lots of kids there, and they just blended into the community and were part of the show. So next year when I go, I don't think I'll leave my little guy at home. I think Kai, my then 4-year-old son, would have a lot of fun looking at all the equipment and animals. But don't take my word for it. Let's hear from some kids.
Are you guys just hanging out and camping, or do you actually go do fiber stuff too?
No, we're just standing around.
I do fiber stuff.
What do you do?
I do spinning, knitting.
Oh, cool.
I do crocheting and maybe spinning soon.
That was Olivia Alegria and Karen Smoot, budding fiber artists. And you know, we really got to be good to the kids because they're the ones who are going to inherit our stash.
Okay, so I'm here at Black Sheep Gathering, standing under a beautiful shady tree, and I found a woman doing something quite interesting. There's a post that's got 3 C-clamps attached to it, and she's got 3 strands of really thick weight silk running from it. And what she's doing, well, let's ask her, what are you doing?
Making a silk rope.
Silk rope.
Here's what an innocent I am. My first thought, vegan mountain climbers. And then I thought maybe people used it to tie up their curtains. Well, apparently her customers are enthusiasts of a different sort and use the silk rope to enhance their love lives. She was producing some very lovely stuff with a really nice hand, and she was very generous with the details of manufacture, but I muffed my iRiver and managed to not record any of the lovely, lovely and quite interesting interviews she gave me, and there you have it. Edgy spinning at Black Sheep Gathering. One of the neat things about traveling to a fiber festival that's out of your area is all the interesting little side trips you can take. I was hanging around the campsite and someone walked by and started describing this wonderful rose garden that was only like 7 blocks away from the fairgrounds. And so Sally Fox really wanted to go see the rose garden, and I love plants and roses, and we heard that there was this cherry tree that was like 150 years old, the oldest cherry tree in the Pacific Northwest. So it was definitely a must do. So we jumped in the car and we found this wonderful rose garden. There were amazing drummers just sort of hanging out and playing, not as a performance, but just a group of young people enjoying the day in an extemporaneous jam session. It was very cool. So next time you're at a fiber festival or traveling around the country, keep your eye out for those little gems that are unexpected. Sometimes those are some of the best memories from your vacation.
So I am at the Eugene Rose Garden with Sally Fox and her daughter. And it is amazing. There is a cherry tree here that is over 150 years old. It's the oldest cherry tree in the Pacific Northwest. And as you can hear, there's some amazing drummers just playing in the park. And there must be hundreds and hundreds of roses here. Climbing roses, floribundas, teas. It's just like a wild fairyland. It's just gorgeous.
After recording these musical drummers at the Rose Garden, I decided that I better get their names and ask for permission to
put them on the podcast.
Here they are in their own words.
Just say your name.
John Elliott.
Carlos Blanco.
Brishan.
These were the wonderful musicians playing the background music and the drumming.
Another long day. Started off with Judith's fiber judging class, then shopped, then ate a hearty late lunch, spun for quite a bit in company with the San Francisco Spinners Guild, Spindles and Flyers, went to a rose garden with Sally Fox and her daughter, set up an interview with Russell Groff from Robin and Russ, bought a beautiful distaff that has a little bar that goes across and you sit on it. And the distaff is just beautiful. It's made of walnut and I felt very medieval. And it actually made the spinning easier because it kept my fiber up off the ground. Really, really enjoyed playing with, even though every time I stood up it tended to fall over. And I found out the guy who makes woolly winders is here. So I need to stop in with him tomorrow and see if he can fix my early run woolly winder. Another peaceful night. A lot of people are up late spinning in their campsites with lanterns. There's a creek that runs by the campground. Oh, and Black Sheep Gathering has showers for the campers. There's two separate showers. The main one is near the livestock pens where the sheep are kept, but there's a better secret one over near the alpacas. And had a nice hot shower. Good water pressure. Enjoyed it very much. Looking forward to tomorrow, where I'll get to interview Russell Groff and take an interlock class. Should be a lot of fun. Talk to you later. This is Sign Mitchell, your roving reporter, signing out.
I'm here at Black Sheep Gathering with Russ Groff of Robin and Russ Hand Weaving, which was mecca for weavers down in McMinnville, Oregon for years and years. And it is quite an honor to be able to sit here and talk with him a little bit before the show opens. So, welcome.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So, how did you get started in hand weaving?
Believe it or not, in the U.S. Army during World War II, I was paralyzed with rheumatic fever and my knee. Couldn't bend my knees and walk. And after 11 months in bed, they said, you're going to learn to walk again by going down to the craft shop and weaving.
Oh, what a cool idea.
And I said, I don't know what you're talking about. So they put me in a wheelchair and took me down to the craft shop and sat me down at a loom, showed me how to throw the shuttle, and I wove a bath mat the first day out of a chenille, heavy chenille.
Oh. And you still remember it. That's amazing.
Yeah, it was very, very nice. And I was so intrigued from then on that nothing else mattered. Even when I went to college, I majored in industrial arts and all I wanted to do was weave, so I made looms in college.
That's really cool. So you were one of those people who knew from the first time that you wove that's what you meant to do.
Yeah. And I made 6 looms while I was in college, and believe it or not, I sold them very well, so I was surprised. So I've been doing it ever since. And I bought my first loom, was the same loom that I wove with in the Army Hospital. It was a J.L. Hammett loom from Cambridge, Massachusetts. And that was the only loom that I could find anywhere on the market at that time. So. But later I found out there were a lot of other looms. At that time, there were, down in Southern California, there was a Binder and Burnham loom being made. And the Gilmore loom was being made in California also. And the Gilmore was my favorite at that time. Yeah. I eventually became an agent for about 4 or 5 years for Mr. Gilmore and selling his looms, and sold them all over the state. And then he decided he didn't want to have any agents because he wanted to make them commissions that had been paying me. So I went to other looms. And I found another loom in Michigan, in Chicago, which was very similar to the Gilmore, called a Norwood. Mm-hmm. And it was a little better, I thought, a little better loom, a little easier to operate than the Gilmore. So I went to visit them, and I actually ended up being a distributor after I left and bought a loom and sold them. And I was the first person on the West Coast to sell Norwood looms. And I sold those in Santa Barbara, California. And then when I moved to Oregon, I was the first one up in Oregon and Washington to sell them also. And I probably sold 200 or 300 Norwood looms over the years. And then about 1965 or so, after I'd been in business for 20-some years or more, I had a chance to try another loom made in California called a Walling loom, W-A-L-L-I-N-G. And I liked it the best of all the looms I had.
What did you like about it?
It was easier to treadle. It was folded up very well, and it was sturdier than most looms were. Sturdier than the Norwood. The Norwood wasn't as sturdy as the others, but it was a good loom.
Mm-hmm.
And so eventually Bill Walling had arthritis so bad in his back he couldn't bend over to work anymore, and he asked if I'd be interested in buying the loom. So I bought it from the rights to Bill from him and built the loom for 15 or 20 years.
Oh, I didn't know that you actually had done loom manufacturing.
Yeah, and I have one loom left at home. I had to change the name, he insisted on that. So we call it the Oregon Trail loom.
Oh, okay. Mm. I've heard of those, but I didn't. So
and that's a very good loom. It's a rigid model, 46 inch. I love the way it works. So
is that what you weave on currently?
I just finished the tablecloth the morning that I came down to this show. I had about 10 inches to go, and I wanted to finish it. So I wove those 10 inches and cut it off the loom and rolled it up and packed it because I'm taking it back to Convergence, and then I'm going to give it to my cousin and his wife back in Pennsylvania.
What weave did you use?
I used my own variation. I have 7 colors in the warp, 2-inch sections of 7 colors, and then I had a twill pointing one way and one color, and the next color that pointed the other way, and then alternate that throughout the whole width of the loom. And then I wanted a little more interest, so I put a rib in between each color the fabric, and that makes it more interesting.
Sounds beautiful.
And they are very nice. I've got one home. I have 2 kitchen towels and 1 tablecloth all woven on the same warp. And I have 16 more yards to go.
So what made you want to open a store?
Well, I went to college to be a teacher. I did student teaching. I didn't like it because they wanted me to make the same things that they'd been making 20 or 30 years. They wouldn't let me use any variety in my teaching in adult education. So I said, well, I'm going to try to get an adult education class started. So I went to the principal of adult education and asked him if I could teach a weaving class. He said, well, we'd love to have you, but we can't because we don't have any equipment and don't have any money to buy it. So I said, well, if I furnish all the looms, can I teach the class? He said, yes. So it took me a year to get 15 looms together.
Now, how did you get those 15?
I bought all used looms for a year.
You really wanted to teach weaving.
And some of them were some that I made also. I had the looms, and I started the adult education class in Santa Barbara. And it's been going ever since. Right now, they have 45 looms in their class, and they have a waiting list to join that class. So something is left from behind that I started.
Yeah, well, your legacy is all over the place. I know many weavers who have their stashes all from Robin and Russ.
Well, I think one of the biggest kicks I got was one day a young girl came in with a baby in her arms, a baby about 2 or 3 years old. She said, "I want to meet Mr. Raw." So the girls brought her over and introduced her to me, and she said, "I wanted to meet you. My grandmother used to buy threads from you."
Oh, wow.
So that would be three generations.
That's amazing. That's a wonderful story. How long was your store open?
Well, I was open in Santa Barbara first. I built a shop in Santa Barbara and opened there in 1952. Worked there till 1962. And then I moved to Oregon. In California, we never sold any wool. As soon as I moved to Oregon, we started selling wool, Oregon and Washington, to people from Oregon and Washington. And my business almost doubled in 1 year by moving up to Oregon.
Oh, wow.
So it's been going strong ever since. I hate to quit, but age and health make me decide I have to quit. And I moved to Nickmanville because all the colleges in Oregon taught weaving at that time, and McMinnville was right in the center. It was Oregon State South, University of Oregon, still further south. Willamette University had weaving. Linfield and McMinnville had weaving. Western Oregon State University had weaving. I was right in the center, so I was supplying looms and equipment to different schools and also yarns for the students.
So did you plan it that strategically?
Yeah, I chose that place because of that.
Oh, that's brilliant.
So that was McMinnville. Then I used to live in, I was born and raised in Pennsylvania. I used to live by California State Teachers College, which was in California, Pennsylvania. Believe it or not, from Oregon, I began to supply them with equipment and looms and other stuff. So it's a small world sometimes.
Yeah, well, weaving tends to be a small world. Yeah. Everybody knows everybody.
Well, talking about that, everybody knows everybody. Let me tell you one of my favorite stories.
Oh, please.
I had a good friend. His name was Clarence Weaver. And he was picked by the federal government to go down to Peru and open a dental lab. He was a dental teacher from Stanford University until he retired. He went down there, and his wife went with him, and they worked for a year at this dental lab down there and teaching him how to make things. And then he decided that when his contract was over to explore Peru, they bought a Fiat and they went exploring. And they went up into the mountains, 11,500 feet high, to Huanco, where the alpaca and llamas live. And there was an Indian woman weaving in their open-air market. And they went over to talk to her and said hello. And finally, Dr. Weaver said, "Well, I have two good friends in Oregon who are Ann Weavers." The Indian lady said, "Oh, you mean Robin and Russ." So it's a small world.
That's amazing.
I've really enjoyed my business. I look forward to it. Also, one of the nice things is that I got to travel because of my business. I discovered that I could buy yarns in England much more reasonable and get a greater variety. So for about 15 years, I went to England once every year and bought a container of yarn.
Oh, wow.
And brought it back and then sold it for the year, then went back and got another one.
Mm-hmm.
And now you can't do that because the mills have all closed down in England. But for a long time, I did just that.
Well, your store has always carried things that you just can't find anywhere else in the U.S.
I always look for the strange things. A couple of trips I went, started in Providence, Rhode Island, and went clear down to South Carolina, visiting every mill along the way, trying to find yarn, different yarn. And I did. And that's how I kept my business going.
I'll speak for weavers everywhere. We really appreciated you scouting out the cool yarns.
Well, I really enjoyed doing that.
So you've had a long career and watched hand weaving evolve. How has it changed since you started?
How has it changed? Well, weavers are lazier. They only use the big threads for warp now. And when I started, 22 Egyptian cotton was the most common warp thread, 22 cotton. And now, very few weavers will try it even. I had a line of about 60 colors of Egyptian cotton, and I had a stock of every color.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I probably sold 10 to 20,000 pounds of that yarn over the years. Came on half-pound tubes, and I'd go to the shows, and it would always be one of the most popular things. Now, I went to one of the first Northern California conferences. Incidentally, they've had 52, and I've been to 49 of them.
Oh, wow.
So that shows you how long I've been in the business. One of the first ones was in Stockton, California. When I went to buy Norwood Looms, I wove samples for their magazine for a couple of years. And then they decided they weren't able to do it anymore and asked if I'd be interested. So I bought the magazine Warp and Web and published that for 40 years.
Now that was with samples
that
in each issue?
That was a sample in every issue. So I had to weave 12 to 15 yards every month.
Oh, wow.
For 40 years. And then after about 2 years, I started another magazine called Drafts and Designs for Multiple Harness, for 5 to 12 harnesses. And I published that for 39 years. And then after that, I figured it was time to quit. Because it was a rat race. You kept going all the time. You always had something to do.
Well, I mean, having a store would be a full-time job, and publishing a magazine would be a full-time job. So it's like you had two.
And I had two 24 yards of the last for 30, 40 years.
So did all that weaving for the magazines really hone your technique?
Yeah. I learned a lot of different techniques, and I tried to demonstrate as many different techniques in my magazine as I could, and that was how I learned weaving. Also, I went to Canada and studied with a man called Stanislaw Zelensky, who was a very able weaver, and he had a magazine he published every month. I subscribed to that, of course, but I went there and studied weaving with him for 2 months. And I went to the Banff School of Fine Arts. Before I bought the magazine from Norwood Loom Company, Warp and Web, I went to the Banff School of Fine Arts and took a 6-week class in weaving. I became the editor of the school bulletin while I was there in order to learn how to print and write Warp and Web. And that was a good start and a good help. And they were two wonderful teachers there, Ethel Henderson and Mary Sandine. And I met Josephine Estes with her miniature patterns, and she had two folios with 24 patterns in each. And I wove every one of the 48 patterns over the years.
I'm actually weaving from her book right now. I'm weaving Star of Bethlehem bookmarks in your 140 over 2 silk.
Good. Wonderful. So. That will be very pretty then.
Yeah, they're beautiful.
Then I went to England and bought a lot of yarns, and I could also found out if I bought directly from the producer, I could sell the yarns at much less than what we're selling for in America.
Mm-hmm.
So I went over to England and bought spinning fibers of all kinds directly from one supplier. For 30 years, I bought from him. I had yak and alpaca and llama long before it became popular here in America.
So what's your favorite thing to weave?
I think tartan. Tartans and silk. Tartans, because I love to see them grow in front of you as you're weaving. And I've designed a couple of tartans that I thought were just fantastically beautiful. One of them had 9 colors in it, so I had 9 shuttles. It was hard to keep track of the...
So you're carrying the threads up the side as you weave, you're not...
No, I was carrying them on the side, yeah.
Right, oh wow, nice.
The salvage was really cut off when they're making clothing and ties and so forth.
Right.
And I had a line of 40 different colors of 2/18 worsted to weave tartans with that I had manufactured for me in England.
Mm-hmm.
And for 20 years I stocked those. And now then that mill went out of business, so gradually I had to discontinue the yarn. About 5 years ago, I had this little odds and ends of all many different colors left of that. So I sent it all up, packed it all up, and sent it to dyer and had it all dyed black. And so I've been selling black 218s worsted ever since. I still, there's some of it right there.
I have bought a bunch of that off of eBay recently, actually. Yeah. So what advice would you give to people who are starting in weaving or thinking about opening a weaving store?
Well, opening a weaving store, first of all, you've got to learn a little bit about weaving before you do that. You've got to weave 10 or 15 projects so you know what you're doing and how to do it and so forth. And then I think you're qualified to open a store. Now, I've sold looms to probably 10 different people that have opened the store after they wove for a year or 2 years or 3 years. I think it's important to get the experience, first of all. Mm-hmm. And then you learn what kind of shuttles and type of equipment you like the best. Now, I was always an advocate of sectional warping because it's about 50% less time to do sectional warping as it is to do chain warp. I looked for directions in many different books and couldn't find any, so finally I wrote my own book and published it called Sectional Warping Made Easy. And I've sold probably 10,000 to 12,000 copies of that over the years.
It's a great little book. I just bought one recently.
On the camping trips, we used to tie ourselves to a pine tree every evening and design a new card weaving pattern. And so I wrote a little book on card weaving. And believe it or not, in 40 years, I sold 32,000 copies of it.
Oh, wow.
So that was our bread and butter money from that particular one.
It's fun to think of you designing the patterns while camping. Yeah.
Just to give you an example, on my card weaving, I wanted something for Easter, so I designed, this was for Halloween, and I wanted pine trees. I lived in Oregon. There was a duck flyway over, so I found a wild geese flying.
Wow.
So you can see how, where I lived, it influenced what I did. These are reindeer, and there was a Santa Claus even.
Yeah, I was amazed at all the figures you were able to get out of card weaving. I didn't know you could do that.
Well, I was fascinating. One time I did a half-hour TV program on card weaving. It was for educational TV with the University of Oregon, but that was a long time ago.
Thank you very much. It's been delightful talking with you.
You're more than welcome. I love to talk about my business. I've enjoyed this for 57 years.
Just came from a talk performed by Dr. Woody Lane on sheep nutrition and how to feed and supplement your animals for optimal health. And I must say he's an interesting lecturer for what is a fairly dry subject and very, very knowledgeable. If you have interest in that area and would like to learn more about it, I would highly recommend his class. Okay, I am standing outside the wool show and sale. I am not going inside because I am not allowed to bring home a raw fleece.
Just got to bed after a lovely evening of spinning and talking. A lot of fun things happened today. First of all, I got to interview Russell Groff of Robin and Russ Hand Weavers, a delightful, delightful man who told me many amusing stories, and I'm just so excited that I was able to sneak in an interview. It was a little bit annoying that the Black Sheep Gathering organizers turned on the fan like 2 minutes before I started my interview, so the background noise must be a little bit more than I had hoped for, but given that, it was a wonderful, wonderful interview, and I hope the audio is usable. After that, I went to a class on how to feed minerals and vitamins to livestock, specifically for fiber animals like sheep and goats and camelids, and it was quite informative. Then I took an interlock knitting class with JC and had just a blast and got my sample done, and she showed me a few other things like
how to weave ends back in. A fun teacher, very encouraging, and had a lot of good ideas about cables because she'd also taught a cable knitting class and some of us were interested, so she gave us some good references and some neat ideas. I would definitely take a class from her again if I was given the opportunity. After that, there was the Black Sheep Gathering potluck, in which lamb were barbecued and everybody else brought a dish to share, and good conversation, good food. I did try the tiniest bit of lamb, though I felt like a complete traitor to Moose and Lola, my two Shetland sheep. So I can only hope it wasn't a Shetland lamb. I doubt it was. I don't think people eat Shetland lambs. There's not enough meat on them. After that, I went to the Spinner's Lead, and this is a special event at the Black Sheep Gathering where a person models a garment that they've made out of hand-spun fiber and leads in a fiber animal representative of the breed that donated the fiber to the project, if not the actual animal. In most cases, it wasn't the actual animal, but it was still cool to see a woman wearing a gorgeous Shetland shawl that she had hand-spun and hand-knit while leading an adorable Shetland lamb, and I took tons of pictures because, of course, you know, I am prejudiced towards Shetlands. After that, came back to the campsite and just hang around and spun in good company. And I've got to say that it's a lot more fun to spin or do fiber arts in company with other good-hearted souls. That was my favorite part of Black Sheep Gathering. Tomorrow, I've got a class in how to sharpen shears. Apparently, they're hollow ground, so it's more difficult than you think. And then I'm going to hit the road and see how my two guys made out while I was gone. In any case, this is Sign Mitchell, your roving reporter, reporting to you from Saturday night at Black Sheep Gathering 2006. This was my first away trip from the guys. The first time I'd been gone for 3 whole nights away. But I have to say, everything went really well. Eric kept the home fires burning. I came home to happy and healthy husband and child. And in fact, let's have a little interview. Let's see how things progressed while I was gone. So, Kai, why don't you tell how you felt when Mommy was at Black Sheep Gathering and you stayed home with Daddy?
Fine. And I like it so much that I run all over the place and couldn't even believe it while you were there. And you became a sheep, and I was surprised.
Did Mommy bring home cool fiber stuff?
Uh-huh.
Did she share any of it with you?
Yeah.
Do you want to go to Black Sheep Gathering next year?
Yeah.
You camp out?
Uh-huh.
In a tent? Should we bring Daddy?
Uh-huh. Might like it.
We'll be right back.
This episode's musical guest is Murder the Stout. They're a Texas band with Irish, Scottish, and Texan influences. Their song, Irish Reels, was the transitional music between different segments and was played in its entirety at the end. I don't know why, but spunky Irish music just seemed very Wool Festival to me. You can check out their music on the web at www.murderthestout.com. I'd like to thank these artists for sharing their music on the Podsafe Music Network. Weavecast is brought to you through the generosity of our donating listeners. This episode is thanks to Gina and Sandra of Southern Comfort Knits. Thank you for your support. Next episode, we'll return to our usual format of studio interviews and audio essays. And please, if you have a tip or trick or a good weaving story you'd like to share with the world, email me at sign, that's S-Y-N-E, at weavecast.com. So now it's time to get warped, because everyone knows you have to be warped to weave.